Now that we've covered lying, let's talk about stealing. Been a really big heist in Europe. Thieves have made off with about $40 million worth of, no, not jewels, not art, carbon emission permits. NPR's Tom Jelton reports.
This is every bit a case of 21st century crime, both in terms of what was stolen and how. In Europe, authorities try to fight global warming by limiting carbon emissions. They allocate a quantity of carbon emission permits to each country, and those levels can't be exceeded. Each country's government then issues those permits to companies that produce carbon, power plants or paper mills, for example.
It is essentially an allowance.
Henry Derwent is president of the International Emissions Trading Association.
This piece of paper allows my company to emit a ton of carbon dioxide through a combustion process.
So that piece of paper has value. Companies that produce less carbon than they're permitted can sell what's left of their allowance to companies that produce more than they should. There's actually a market where these allowances are traded electronically. And what's happened over the past few months, but especially in the last week, is that some criminals were able to break into one of the registries where those carbon allowances were recorded. Next, says Henry Derwent, they were able to change who owns what.
Then if you make sure that it's transferred to an account that you own and you sell it very quickly, then you've essentially got something for nothing, sold it for a lot, and you get out of town with all the dollars in your bag.
A cyber theft like that would not have happened 20 years ago, nor would a carbon emission allowance have had any value 20 years ago. What this theft proves, Derwin points out, is that in Europe, carbon emission allowances are now seen as commodities.
Like gold, like wheat, like whatever. That means that people treat it very, very seriously. But it also means that it's got value on the market. And if you find that you're not defending it as you would something of value, if your security is lax, hey, people are going to recognize if you don't recognize that this is valuable, we do, and we'll try and steal it from you.
So from Derwent's point of view, there's a silver lining to this story. It shows that European attempts to limit carbon emissions must be working. On the other hand, if companies start worrying that their carbon allowances could get stolen, the whole system could fail. So the European Commission is anxious to put an end to this new crime. For the time being, trading in carbon allowances has been suspended. Tom Jelton, NPR News, Washington.
This is NPR News.
This is a new piece of music. Some people call it ethereal, multi-layered, a soundscape that reminds them of Philip Glass or Stephen Reich. And if you like them, this should appeal to you as well. The thing about this piece is that it's the work of an artist somewhat less obscure than the ones I just mentioned. The song is actually called You Smile, and the artist, it's tween heartthrob Justin Bieber. I wait on you forever. Justin Bieber is not responsible for that earlier piece, but they are the same exact song. This song is this song. This version is the song slowed down 800 times. And last summer, a producer posted it online, and it became an internet phenomenon. Thousands and actually millions of people went to hear it. And it turns out that a lot of producers are starting to do the same thing with other music, including one of our own producers, Brent Bachman, who is in the studio with me to explain why. Why are they doing this?
They're doing it because there's this really simple software. It's free. It's easy to use. It's called Paul's Extreme Sound Stretch, and it allows anyone to plug in a song and slow it down hundreds, even thousands of times. And online, people go crazy for this stuff.
In these discussions.
Yeah, they go crazy for it, and they call it cosmic and ethereal, and they compare it to Brian Eno's early work.
His early work, not his later work.
His early work, right. And the most recent example of this was this past week, someone took the music from the film Jurassic Park.
Ah, yes.
This music right here. And then they took it and they slowed it down 1,000 times. Listen to this.
That's amazing. Aaron Copland, right? I'm thinking like majestic.
Early Aaron Copland.
Early, of course, right. Early Aaron. So amazing stuff.
Yeah, and that's what most people online say, too.
But does this work with any song? Can you plug any song into this program?
That's the thing. Yeah, I think it might. Let me give you a few examples. Take a listen to this first one.
Okay. Oh, that's gorgeous. Shimmering. Shimmering, yeah. That kind of build up. That,
mm-hmm. Any guesses?
No idea. Beautiful. Wow. I did not know Lady Gaga had this in her.
She's a talented lady.
She is indeed.
People go Gaga. Okay, let's hear another one. This is my favorite stretched song.
Wow. I believe that this is the King's College Cambridge men's choir.
You're hearing some church acoustics there?
Yeah. Am I right?
No.
Wow.
You're hearing a ukulele is actually what you're hearing.
That is the same song.
Yeah, Train's Hey Soul Sister.
Train's Hey Soul Sister.
Maybe the worst song of the year.
In your opinion.
Yeah. Okay, let me play you one more that I've stretched out. Kind of sinister.
Yeah. You could imagine this being used in a movie.
Just before the killer strikes.
Just before.
And this song was one of the biggest hits in the year 2000.
I'm blue. I'm blue. This song is an awesome song.
It's a really awful song.
We'll disagree on that one. But that's the same song.
That's the same song. Bad song.
Okay.
I'm going to emphasize again. But if you start with a really complex song, you hear that there are even more possibilities for this kind of technology. Let's take Beethoven's Ninth.
Yeah? Okay, yep.
Originally, it's a little more than an hour.
Right.
But back in 2002, a Norwegian producer created a version of the Ninth Symphony slowed down to last 24 hours.
24 hours.
It's called Nine Beat Stretch. So this is Nine Beat Stretch. There's an artist in San Francisco named Aaron Zim.
Mm-hmm.
Last year, he hosted a listening event at a warehouse there, and he invited people to come and spend 24 hours listening to this music.
It's that quality of suspension and the pace of our lives and the rapidity with which we shift from one multitask task to another to actually stay with something for as long as this technique allows you to do. It's kind of a novel experience.
24 hours. I hope you serve food there.
I didn't ask him that. They did have beanbags, though.
Hmm.
Hearing sound like this gives your brain the opportunity to move into synchrony with it and itself slow down. You realize that you don't have to be in a hurry. You can sort of stay here for a while and take a look around with your ears.
I don't know if I'd want to hear it for 24 hours, but it is, I mean, it really is amazing.
What if you had a beanbag?
Maybe.
Okay. Let me play you one more. This is from an artist you had on the show last week,
right.
One of my favorites. A track from the new Decemberists album.
Yes.
Yeah? That I think sounds great at any speed.
Right.
But listen to it slowed down about 50 times. Recognize that?
No. Which song is this?
I'm not telling you. But we'll put the answer in our podcast this week,
along
with a few more slowed down songs.
All right, Brent. Thanks so much.
Sure.
And by the way, you can find our podcast at npr.org/weekendATC. We post a new episode on Sunday nights.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Alyssa Block.
And I'm Michelle Norris, and it's time now for All Tech Considered. Google is getting a new leader, or more accurately, an old one. Larry Page is returning to his job as CEO. 10 years ago, Eric Schmidt was brought in to run Google by its 20-something co-founders, including Page. Now Schmidt is stepping aside. As NPR's Laura Seidel reports, Larry Page is notoriously shy, and many wonder how he will fare as head of the world's largest internet company.
Larry Page has been obsessed with technology since he was a child. As an undergraduate at the University of Michigan, he majored in engineering and for fun built an inkjet printer out of Legos. Ken Auletta, the author of Googled, The End of the World as We Know It, says the question is, can he run the company?
He's not a particularly good speaker. He is not a particularly sociable guy. He hates people micromanaging his schedule. He doesn't like to be confined. Well, a CEO is confined.
Page isn't known as the kind of guy who's good at schmoozing with other executives, also part of being a CEO. Auletta says the first time Page met with media mogul Barry Diller, Page was looking down and typing on his PDA while Diller tried to talk to him.
And he says, Larry, I'm trying to talk. Can you just converse with me? He said, it's okay, Barry. I can do both. I can look at this device and talk to you. He says, no, Larry, choose. And Larry, without looking up, says, I choose this.
But Page has also been watching the more experienced Eric Schmidt run the company for 10 years. Page also read a book as a young man about one of his heroes that brought home how important it is to be good at business. The inventor Nikola Tesla, along with Thomas Edison, was pivotal to the development of electricity.
And he wound up dying destitute because, unlike Thomas Edison, he wasn't a good businessman.
Page also likes to solve problems, and he'll bring that to pushing Google forward, says David Vise, author of The Google Story. For example, he grew up outside of Detroit and was always bothered by traffic jams and accidents.
And he actually has thought about such things as automated cars that drive themselves and move at a kind of optimal speed without ever causing accidents or ever causing slowdowns.
Google recently announced that it's working on a car that drives itself. In the last 2 years, Page has watched his company start to look like the old guard in Silicon Valley as Facebook has taken on the mantle of the innovative upstart. Vise thinks that Page is really going to push to reclaim that mantle.
And that's really the key for a company like this, to stay out in front, to stay ahead, and to continually surprise and delight users.
Vise says Page will bring a lot of energy and enthusiasm to the helm. Among his favorite phrases is that it's important to have a healthy disregard for the impossible. Laura Seidel, NPR News, San Francisco.
"40% of the people who play video games in the U.S. are female. That's according to the Entertainment Software Association, an industry group. But as 17-year-old Jessica Cernadas sees it, video games are designed to appeal to guys. And she tells us that is very frustrating.
Oh, my God, the pink dude is right there. Just learn to die.
Yes.
I love video games.
You're crazy. You talk to the game. You scream at the game.
God! Ugh.
I blame my mom.
Well, you never liked dolls.
I chopped off all the hair.
And I didn't care.
I used to play only with my friends. But now I play hardcore games online, where most of the other gamers are guys. And they're just really rude.
Whoever I've seen that's a girl sucks at it.
Finish him. That's Uzi, one of my friends from school.
Every time there's a girl talking on a mic, I try to flirt with her.
Ugh, it doesn't surprise me.
Do you think you're better than most guys?
Hell yes.
Stephanie's one of the best gamers I know.
I have beaten most guys in my school, so yes.
So let's say you've been playing against a guy, right, and you told them that you were a girl. Would they not believe you, or have they not believed you?
Well, I told this one dude, and he didn't believe me because I beat him by 1 point. And he goes, oh, okay, if you were a girl, then show me some
beep.
I was like, no.
It's hard to get any confidence when you're constantly mocked. And the way women are portrayed in these games doesn't help either.
In real life, if a girl ever fights, they usually have, like, sneakers and, like, loose shirts. But in, like, games, they have...
I have about 21 PlayStation games. And only 2 have a female as a protagonist. Characters like Bayonetta do kick serious butt. It's just that her freaking final move is where all her clothing comes off and transforms into a freaking dragon.
Bayonetta.
The men in these games...
Guys will be strong.
...are made to be beautiful.
Muscular,
tall.
Cool.
And just plain awesome.
Oh, yeah, yeah. And, like, usually you have to save the girl in the game. Most games. Heroic. Yeah.
Nice.
The person giggling is Karen Law, the only female employee at Uber Entertainment, a small game developing company in Washington. She's testing their new game with John Combs, the creative director. Karen Law plays online as Hellchick.
I guess looking back on it, people ask me, why did you pick a name that was Hellchick, that's obviously a woman? I'd say, well, I didn't really do it deliberately, but I'm also not going to change it just because I don't feel like I should have to hide behind my gender.
Just a couple months ago, Karen and I were playing Modern Warfare online, and as soon as she said something, lo and behold, somebody's like, whoa, Hellchick, you're a chick. You sound hot. Are you hot? And it just, like, unraveled from there, and Karen's like, mute, I'm muting. Hold on a second, I'm going to mute all these guys. And it's just, that's when I was embarrassed for my gender, actually.
I can't help you out there, Mr. Combs. You're the creative director. You should have some say in what goes on. We want strong women who can punch and kick and fucking punch without taking off their itty-bitty strips of cloth.
I think that it's possible to make female characters be not hypersexualized.
Karen Law actually told me she's working on a game with a girl character who's completely covered. And she's a ninja.
But a bit of a catch-22 in that in order to make more games that would appeal to more women, you really need to have more women helping to make them. But in order to get more women to help make them, you have to have more games that appeal to them in the first place.
I need to play to get my juices flowing so I can create my own super awesome sci-fi adventure strategy game where women rule and men are dressed in Speedos. Ew.
That's 17-year-old Jessica Cernadas. Her story comes to us from Radio Rookies at member station WNYC in New York City.
You're listening to NPR.
The revolution in Tunisia began with one street vendor who set himself on fire out of despair and anger. Many young Tunisians first heard of his story on the internet, and they then used social media to communicate and organize around their cause. Tunisia has been called the first successful Twitter revolution. While social media activists are taking notes, so too are Arab governments. NPR's Deborah Amos reports from Riyadh, Saudi Arabia.
With 3 million on Facebook and internet usage up 400% in a year, Saudi Arabia has a social media revolution. This is the sound of a Twitter feed. The bite-sized comments come in torrents here. Recently, many focused on Tunisia. In fact, Saudi social media activists spread videos and updates at the peak of the street protests, and the interest has stayed high ever since. But what now? Will the Saudi government clamp down on this freewheeling speech?
That's a good question. And I was wondering what or when would we see the effect of Tunisia on us?
That's Hatoun El Fassi, a professor and political activist.
Everybody, politically speaking, are on their nerves. They're not happy with anything that goes on in the media. For example, when I wrote my article today, it was refused.
El Fassi felt the chill firsthand when she delivered her weekly newspaper column. She wrote about Arab government's response to events in Tunisia, and she had to defend the topic to her editor.
Everything I've written was actually from the news. I haven't put anything new. I said, yeah, still, but you put them all together.
While Saudi Arabia still controls the domestic media, it's harder to block out international news. But for the first time, the government has published new regulations for the electronic media. Users, including bloggers, are encouraged to register with the government. The rules prohibit criticism of Islam or anything that compromises public order, rules which spurred an outburst of criticism online.
I believe this is an ugly tactic of censoring freedom of expression.
That's Mohammed Khatani, and he heads the Saudi Civil and Political Rights Association, an unofficial human rights group that publishes provocative challenges to the government on a website registered outside the country.
And they do censor our website. Over the past year, it has been blocked more than 15 times. Can you imagine? Almost every 2 weeks, they will just shut it down. But we figure out how to do it.
And that's the thing, says Prince Turki Al Faisal, a former diplomat and head of intelligence. It's impossible to clamp down on the web.
If you want to get to a certain website, who can prevent you? You can hook your phone to a provider in Ukraine or Timbuktu. It is not a means to clamp down, but rather simply to regulate them.
But this week, Human Rights Watch reports that the Saudi government has harassed and jailed critics and warns that the new regulations are likely to suppress electronic communications. The Human Rights Watch report also notes there's a lively exchange of views on the Saudi web, and even government officials check on blog sites to monitor what's going on in the kingdom. This is a YouTube posting of the 2009 floods in Jeddah. More than 70 people died. The government contained the damages after responding to YouTube reports and Facebook groups that were way ahead of local officials in reporting the crisis.
The young scientists I've spoken to about this plan to get bloggers registered just laugh. There are all sorts of technical ways that I don't quite understand of getting around it and blogging under an assumed name.
Robert Lacey has lived in Saudi Arabia for decades and written about the royal family. He says the internet poses a challenge for this conservative, mostly religious society.
It's one of the big questions ahead for Saudi Arabia, how this authoritarian regime will live with the freedom and chaos that the internet represents.
So far, the social media revolution has been a limited success, but that was before the uprising in Tunisia. Deborah Amos, NPR News, Riyadh.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Melissa Block.
And I'm Michelle Norris. Many of you may know this tune. It's the intro music from Angry Birds, a wildly popular digital diversion. The game has been downloaded more than 50 million times in the last year. And now a major toy maker is getting a low-tech slice of the Angry Birds pie. Gigi Duban reports.
Whenever Chris Clark fires up his iPhone or iPad, he's on autopilot. His fingers invariably go to the same place, to the game folder containing the Angry Birds app. Clark has easily more than 100 games downloaded to his devices, but after Solitaire, Angry Birds is his favorite. He's not the only one. In 2010, Angry Birds was Apple's best-selling iPhone app. It's also available on Android. Clark, an industrial electronics repairman from Birmingham, Alabama, says he plays Angry Birds during downtime at work, on the sofa, waiting in line, and, well, just about any time he can. In other words, he's addicted.
You keep retrying the harder levels until you get it, and then you're like, okay, next, come on. And you just keep going, and you stop when somebody yells dinner or it's time to go to work.
Part of what makes it so addictive, Clark says, is that it's easy. You basically hurl birds through a slingshot at a castle. Inside the castle are these ugly green pigs. They stole the bird's eggs, so the object of the game is revenge. That's something a lot of people can relish in, but so is the simple pleasure of breaking things. Mattel knows this. Just ask Raymond Adler, the company's marketing manager for games and puzzles.
People love building things so that they can go and knock them down.
So Mattel is putting the finishing touches on an Angry Birds board game due to hit store shelves in May. It'll sell for about $15.
This is sort of our first venture into bringing things from the digital space into the physical space.
Adler says Mattel still sells tons of board games, but there's a lot more competition out there. Games played on computers, mobile devices, and all sorts of gadgets take away market share from Mattel.
Some of the ways that we're trying to combat that is exactly with things like Angry Birds.
It's a way for Mattel to keep a foot in both worlds. The challenge in going from digital to board game isn't unlike what a screenwriter faces when making a film out of a book. True to the digital game, there will be a slingshot. Only in the board game version, and this may come as a disappointment to some, the birds will not come apart and explode on impact with the castle, which players build out of blocks.
No, the birds stay in one piece so that you can play over and over again.
And Mattel hopes people do. The company wouldn't say how much it invested in the Angry Birds board game, but analysts say it can't be much. After all, Rovio, the company that developed the Angry Birds app, pretty much provided the framework.
They don't have to go out and develop a whole lot of intellectual property to create a new board game.
That's Paul Swinand, an analyst with Morningstar.
If it's not a success, it's not going to be a black eye or probably even a loss for them because they probably have very good margins on it.
If it sells at all, it'll have been a good experiment for Mattel, a nice way to dip the company's toes into the world of digital apps. Still, even Adler says it's pretty unlikely that the Angry Birds board game will ever outsell toys like Barbies and Matchbox cars. But Adler says you just never know. And as big as Angry Birds is, he says, it's definitely a risk worth taking. For NPR News, I'm Gigi Duban in Birmingham, Alabama.